This is a HeadGum Original.
What interferes with your happiness? Something preventing you from achieving your goals? I feel like we talk a lot about disappointment on this podcast. How hard it is for all of us when we don't get what we want and things aren't going our way. In my own experience, I can't help but think that there were times when it might have been healthier if I had talked to somebody who was qualified to help me deal with my disappointment back when I was really feeling it. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp, which can connect you with a licensed professional therapist based on your specific personal needs. It's safe, it's convenient, it's online. You can start communicating in less than 24 hours. And it's not self-help, it's professional counseling. BetterHelp will make sure you find the therapist who's right for you. And they make it easy and free to change counselors if you need to until you find the one you're happy with. It's more affordable than traditional offline, in-person counseling, and financial aid is available. You can send a message to your counselor anytime and you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, all without ever having to go to a physical office and sit in a waiting room. And because BetterHelp isn't limited by geography, there is a broad range of expertise available, a lot more than you might have access to wherever you're currently living. Licensed professional counselors who are specialized in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem. Anything you share is confidential, of course. You can check out the testimonials posted daily on their site. Start living a healthier life today. Listeners of this podcast get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/deadeyes. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/deadeyes.
And well, I've told you how I feel. I can't even hear the name these days, and I think, oh God, do you happen to know what you did to this young actor who was just starting out? I've always wanted to meet him and say that to him. And believe me, I would.
Hillary Gagan was my first agent. She signed me right out of drama school, and for almost 2 years she got me auditions, most of which did not lead to me booking work. She was the first person in show business who believed in me, who looked at me and said, "This is a person who has enough talent to do this for a living." I remember that Hillary was very excited when I was in the running for Band of Brothers and when I finally booked it. Talking to her now, I was surprised by how intensely she still felt about my firing, even after 20 years.
Well, I was very honest when I replied to your email about the fact that you've never been off my mind because I'm still so angry about that situation.
And she had a lot of things to say about Tom Hanks.
I haven't seen all his films, so I'm not a huge Tom Hanks fan.
A lot of things.
I think his best film is Polar Express, when it's not the real thing. And I've always, and I mean...
And you know what I think it is? I think Hillary still feels protective of the version of me that she knew back then. Even now, when she's no longer my agent, she can't help thinking about me in terms of directions my career could go.
Well, I have to tell you that I think your voice is really good.
Oh, thank you.
I just love the sound of a person's voice. Always loved a person's voice. James Earl Jones is a voice that you could eat tomato soup to. So I think your voice has got that sort of quality.
It is very flattering to be compared to the great James Earl Jones. I personally don't hear it. But in addition to Hillary having perhaps a different idea of me than I have of myself, I also found out that she has continued to process what happened to me. She never let go of it, even after I was long gone.
I don't think there's possibly a week or a month goes by without me thinking about that situation because it was so unfair. And you immediately, well, you took the decision to go back to America because, I mean, what could we do to make that up to you? And in a way, it was totally out of our hands. And that's what I didn't like about the whole setup.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
My name is Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 20 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks. The story I was told at the time, he had seen my audition tape, and he thought that I had dead eyes.
I'm sorry, dead eyes? Why do you say that to an actor? I mean, my instant thing at the moment is that was I'll wear glasses then.
And that's the short version. You know, it's been over 20 years since...
I know.
Since I moved to London and I graduated from Lipa. And I think the first thing you would have seen of me would have been when Lipa did the showcase in London.
Yeah, that's right.
Lipa is the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts, which is a school co-founded by Sir Paul McCartney. The whole reason I had ended up in England was that this new high-profile school was opening up, and they came to America to hold auditions for international students. My thinking was that there would be an industry spotlight on Lipa's first graduating class, that I would have a greater chance of getting an agent when I was finished. There was a showcase designed to help us all find representation in London.
You were the only person that I got an offer from.
Right.
It meant a lot to me, especially because I remember one of the people who was running the school saying, Hillary Gagan, she's good. You signing me was what made me feel like, oh, I could be a professional actor. It's not just a pipe dream.
Yes, yes, yeah.
You were a professional saying, I think that you're talented enough to work in this business.
Yes, and you were. And you probably still are. But I remember, you know, every agent sort of looks at actors, especially at drama school, and sees where there's a gap in their books that an actor would fit. And I remember you being quite tall. I remember you being, you know, you were American, which was very attractive. And I thought I could do something with you. As you know, you were one of probably about 30-odd, so you stood out. And that's what I liked.
The first thing that I booked was the Reduced Shakespeare Company, which was, I think, a year and a half long touring job where I would be the understudy. But I was waiting to hear about the play at the Royal Court Theater, which I really wanted, which was a much shorter run. That was like an 8-week job as opposed to a year and a half of consistent work. I thought this would be considered kind of a foolish move on my part because I didn't have a yes on that Royal Court job yet when I had to give an answer about turning down a year and a half of work. And I remember thinking, I don't want to go on tour for a year and a half and have to memorize all three parts but not get to perform most of the time. If there was a chance I was going to get this really good part in this play at the Royal Court, that was like the kind of work that I wanted to do. And I remember being so kind of scared and nervous about telling you because it meant I had to say, I'd like to say no to this offer of work because I might get this much less lucrative and short-term gig that might also say no to me. And I ended up getting that play. But I remember you were very understanding, but also I remember you saying, well, you're turning down a job for a thing that you might not get that also is going to be over very soon. Do you remember that at all?
I do, because the one thing I've always, I hope I said to you as well, is I always say to my clients is don't be afraid to say no. I mean, you've got to go and you've got to do the job. I don't. I'm sitting in an office somewhere, you know. It's great to be offered, you know, a 15-month tour. But if the excitement was with the shorter version at the Royal Court, then that's what you should go for. Because money's okay, but it's experience and working with people and a good director and stuff like that, which is more exciting in the long run. It's so difficult. When you're new to it, you're not really sure which way to go.
The feeling that I had walking around London when I was in the play, when that feeling was gone, then I very much felt like, oh no, I'm not an actor. Like, I'm just an out-of-work person trying to be an actor.
Ah, right, okay.
Because I couldn't believe it when my job was to rehearse for a play, and that was all I had to do to pay my rent.
I know, lovely.
And then performing in the play, and that was my life. And I could do whatever I wanted the rest of the day because I made enough money doing the play to pay my rent. And when that was suddenly gone, and then I was working at Ticketmaster in Leicester Square, I felt like I was surrounded by all these theaters.
No, it's taken away from you.
And I think in some ways that was what made the Band of Brothers experience particularly vulnerable for me, is because I'd had a year of getting sort of knocked down, and then booking that job and then finding out that Tom Hanks was going to be directing me, it sort of made me feel like, oh no, I'm confident again. When I was Hillary's client, I was auditioning primarily for American roles, but this also meant that the opportunities to audition for things were less frequent. And that made me nervous because there were fewer opportunities to actually succeed at booking work. And I always had the thought that if enough time went by without me getting cast in something, there was a chance that Hillary would drop me as a client.
No, I'm not that sort of agent. I mean, my job is to help and to move people through their career. And I mean, you know, this happens. I mean, it's life, isn't it? Shit happens. And I've never knowingly let anyone go unless there were some real problems. But no, because I always feel we're in it together. Because if I've got the faith and in you as an actor, I'm very careful about who I put in for what role. And that's my anxiety, because I mean, I would love it if they all worked, because that means they'd be earning money, they'd be respecting themselves for that. And that is what an actor wants, you know, that whole progression of being seen and maybe going up the next notch of the ladder. Because you were here at a good time. You know, there was still that genuine love of being in a theatre and doing, you know, the classics or whatever. And that's sort of changed now. It's so commercial that I find it a little depressing at times. I mean, is there another film they can make a musical of? I don't know. Probably. A theatre has opened here with a musical of Sleepless in Seattle.
This is a new musical of Sleepless in Seattle?
Yeah. Called Sleepless.
Yet another Tom Hanks connection.
Yes, it is.
Even without intending to, it always circles back in some way. The more we talked, I thought it was slightly strange that Hillary hadn't commented on me being told I had dead eyes. I was waiting for her to bring it up, and I started to think that maybe she didn't remember it. But prying further revealed that she had an entirely different memory.
When they phoned me to say that you were not going to do the film, I went, well, you know, what's wrong? And it was Suzanne Smith, who was the casting director, and she said, well, we need Connor to come out and to the studio, and we need to talk to him. And I went, well, what's going on? I mean, the bottom line is, and I thought she would go through that with you, but the bottom line is, Tom Hanks promised his nephew that role.
His nephew?
Yeah.
I don't, well, because the guy who ended up getting it was an actor named Adam Sims.
Well, I don't know, but at that moment in time, she'd had a call from the States saying that he had promised his nephew a role in Band of Brothers, and that was the role he was going to give him. So, I don't know, because by then, I mean, I went slightly ballistic, and I said, this is, you know, God, nepotism. I mean, you know, please, we don't need that. There's enough characters in this. You could make one up. But that was what I was told.
I'm going to also check levels. I keep my eye on that as well. Anyway, I'll adjust that if things go crazy, which they shouldn't.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to start screaming at any point. I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this question, but I feel like I need to do my due diligence and ask you.
Okay.
Are you Tom Hanks's nephew?
No.
All right. Good. Well, that's what I thought the answer would be. That's what I thought. 100%. That's what I thought the answer would be. But I had to ask because her memory of what happened.
I felt like I needed to go back and talk to Adam Sims, the actor who replaced me, just because I had never specifically asked whether or not he was Tom Hanks's nephew. And he, of course, had never volunteered any kind of denial to that effect. So now we have it on the record.
Yeah, I can confirm I'm not related in any way to Tom Hanks.
To the best of your knowledge.
To the best of my knowledge, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm going to go deep into some sort of Da Vinci Code level genealogy. I think this is probably where we'll leave it. We'll take you at your word.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
The two other guys who were in the car, did either of them say anything about, like, we're going to see my uncle?
No.
All right.
I gotta say, yeah, uncle or, yeah, family didn't come up. I don't recall family coming up. Maybe there is a nephew out there.
I mean, there could be, but if it doesn't directly have to do with Zelensky, I feel like it falls far beyond the scope of what I'm looking at here.
You know? Could be another podcast.
Oh, and that's somebody else's podcast. That's not for me. Okay, but now I'm left to wonder, where did the nephew thing come from? How have I never heard this before? And Hillary seemed equally surprised by my memory of what had happened.
No, I don't remember that. I mean, now I've been in the business for so long, I can see the tricks of the trade and, the non-transparency, shall we say. But Suzanne and I were quite good friends at that moment. And then she obviously taped you and the tapes went back to America. And there was a yes. And then he re-looked at it, but she said to me, between you and me, he wants his nephew in this film.
We reached out once again to casting directors Suzanne Smith and Gary Davey, just to see if they wanted a chance to comment on any of this, but the only response we've ever gotten from them is good luck with the podcast and a polite but firm rejection of the idea of ever talking to me.
Because I said to Suzanne, I cannot tell my client he's just been fired.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't been fired. He got the job. And whether it was just that he thought you had dead eyes, which I find an excuse, to be honest, and whether he didn't know how to get out of that, there has to be, something else here. It doesn't ring right for me. I really disrespect that. And we all react in different ways, don't we, to things. However, I don't think sometimes we understand the hurt we inflict on someone. And that's what really angered me.
I mean, it's memory is a tricky thing. There's always the part of me that's worried that I'm conflating things so that I have gotten details wrong, because I have no memory of the nephew thing being said to me at any point.
Well, I think you want there to be an explanation. And to be honest with you, Connor, you didn't get an explanation.
I think I got a few explanations and it's hard
to know.
Yeah,
well, too many maybe, but all our memories, dissipate in a funny sort of way. Has this experience completely sort of colored your life?
I mean, I think if it wasn't this, it would have been something else. There was one last thing that I was hoping Hillary could help me with. Something I had forgotten. And she was maybe the only person in a position to help me recover it. The identity of her assistant back then. There were two possibilities that she could think of, and she still was in touch with both of them.
But I will do that. I will find out what their contact. Jonathan, I'm sure, will come back to me, but I will ask Robert first, because he may well have been the person you spoke to. Leave that with me. I promise to do that.
When we return, I'm going to talk with him. We'll be right back. In the movie Big, 13-year-old Josh Baskin is tired of being a kid, so he makes a wish using an antique fortune-teller machine he sees at a carnival, Zoltar. I wish I were big. His wish is granted. And the next morning, he has turned into 32-year-old Tom Hanks. The movie never explains how this works. We just accept it. The power of Zoltar. It's magic. And the proof is that it happens. We see it with our own eyes. And that is how it felt when I received my new mattress from Helix Sleep. I thought, this can't be it. It's small. But it turns out, by the power of Zoltar, it very quickly expands to full size. Like magic. Of course, you don't need Zoltar to find the right mattress for you. Helix Sleep has already pre-granted your wish. They have a quiz you can take online. It's really quick, takes about 2 minutes, and they can tell you exactly which mattress is right for your body type and sleep preferences. Everybody's different, and Helix knows that. So they have several different kinds of mattresses to choose from. They have soft, medium, firm mattresses, mattresses to cool you down if you sleep hot, and even a Helix Plus mattress for plus-size folks. I took the Helix quiz, and I was matched with the Midnight Luxe mattress because I wanted something that would accommodate tossing and turning, was neither too soft nor too firm. It feels great. And it reminded me of another part in the movie Big, where Josh Baskin has to stay in a cheap hotel in New York City. If you go back and look at that scene, that mattress he's on looks really uncomfortable. Makes you think Josh Baskin could have used a follow-up wish for a new mattress from Helix Sleep. Matched to his specific needs as a 13-year-old trapped in a 32-year-old's body. So if you're looking for a mattress, it's really simple. You take the quiz, you order the mattress that you're matched to, and the mattress comes right to your door, shipped for free. You don't ever need to go to a mattress store again. My mattress is very comfortable, but you don't have to take my word for it. Helix was awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 by GQ and Wired Magazine. Just go to helixsleep.com/deadeyes. Take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for 100 nights risk-free. They'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it. But you will. Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners at helixsleep.com/deadeyes. That's up to $200 off all mattress orders plus 2 free pillows at helixsleep.com/deadeyes. You've got balls. Shaving Mr. Balls. Charlie Wilson's balls. The man with 2 shaved balls. What am I doing here? I'm talking about balls using the titles of various Tom Hanks films, in case that wasn't clear. Support for Dead Eyes comes from Manscaped, the best in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Maybe you nickname yours Turner and Hooch, Buzz and Woody. Everyone's different. Maybe you call both of yours Wilson, like in the movie Castaway. Remember how unruly Chuck Nolan's hair was by the end of that film? I mean, we never saw him fully naked, but we can do some basic body hair algebra and solve for X, can't we? There wasn't a lot of manscaping going on while he was figuring out how to make fire. Assuming you aren't stranded on some uncharted tropical island, it may be time to gear up and get yourself the gift of shaving this holiday season. I am talking about the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0. Remember in A League of Their Own, when Tom Hanks says the classic line, "There's no crying in baseball!" Well, now, thanks to Manscaped, there's no crying in shaved balls. Because this revolutionary company has redesigned the electric trimmer. Their Lawnmower 3.0 has proprietary advanced skin-safe technology, so this trimmer cuts on your nuts. From now on, there will be no more shaving privates crying. It's also waterproof, so you can use it in the shower. Or if you live in the ocean with your girlfriend who's a mermaid. The Lawnmower 3.0 comes inside their brand new Perfect Package 3.0, which makes for the perfect gift this holiday season. It's literally everything you need to keep trimmed, cut-free, and smelling nice down there. And please, don't sully things by using the same trimmer on your face as you're using on your balls. That would be a big mistake. The Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0 also includes the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. You already put deodorant on your armpits. Do your part to make sure it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood down there. And by neighborhood, I am of course referring to the area down by where your balls are. We can't know for certain what the great Fred Rogers would have made of the Manscaped Crop Reviver, but I'd like to think he would have said, thank you for this product, along with the Crop Preserver, and would have welcomed the refreshing, clean feeling they added to his regimen. I mean, use your imagination, but I'm just saying that if that FedEx package Chuck Nolan was holding onto in Castaway had contained a bunch of Manscaped products, he might have felt a lot more comfortable living on that island. And Wilson might have even appreciated it. You know what I'm saying? The perfect package will also come with a pair of Manscaped boxers that'll keep your burbs feeling fresh all day. It's time to upgrade that overused pair of boxers to Manscaped's high-performance anti-chafing boxers. Tis the season to manscape, so get yourself, your dad, your brother and friends the best gift of all, the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code DEADEYES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code DEADEYES. Clean up your nuts and make Santa proud this year.
Is there a way that we can get that motherfucking agent assistant on this podcast?
I don't remember who it was. I'm so bad with names. And
right.
Two decades went by and I don't remember who it was.
God, I hate that person. Truly, deeply hate that person. Although, whatever, it's probably given you a lot of gold in your life. But, like, what a thing to tell an actor.
It only is in recent years that it occurred to me that I shouldn't have been told that.
Right.
Because it really put me in my head. You might recognize that clip from our first episode when my friend Darcy Carden was talking in the abstract about the person in Hillary's office who called me on the phone, told me I needed a re-audition for Tom Hanks. Back when we recorded that conversation over a year ago, I really couldn't imagine I'd ever be able to track down who that person was and talk to them again. I had no sense of how many assistants Hillary had had over the years. And I didn't even remember any names until Hillary suggested putting us in touch. Hillary mentioned two people who it might have been, Jonathan and Robert. And both names seem equally familiar to me. We later confirmed that based on the timeline of when Jonathan started working for Hillary, it had to be Robert. But honestly, the second I heard his voice on the phone, I immediately knew that it was him. This was the voice of the person who would call me up and tell me whenever I had an audition, who told me what Tom Hanks thought of my eyes.
In that sort of two-year period, you and I would have talked on the phone.
We'd have had a phone relationship, definitely, because I was the frontline phone person.
But more than even knowing I had the right person, there was a bigger question. Would an agent's assistant who spent years making countless phone calls to actors and casting directors day after day have even the slightest memory of one specific, devastating phone call from 20 years ago?
I needed to be prompted about it. And when I heard about it, I did remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Having been an actor myself, there was nothing more terrifying and awful than knowing that you had to phone somebody up and give them the worst news possible. I mean, we all felt so terrible. There seemed to be the most incredible injustice that you could be offered a part and a contract can be raised and the deal is done and you're all excited. You've told your friends and your family, I'm going to be doing this. This is how amazing. I'm sorry. Nothing to do with us, but they've changed that. Could you just ring us? can you call in, please? And we will try to soften the blow. I mean, it's just, how do you soften the blow like that? It's absolutely appalling.
I believe you were trying to get a hold of me maybe on the Friday or over the weekend. And by the time you got a hold of me on Monday morning, it was very frantic. Does that ring a bell with you?
No.
I was hoping that I would be able to trigger Robert's memory of the call, that there would be some detail that would bring it all rushing back to him. But I ended up telling him the entire story, all the way up to the part about him telling me that Tom Hanks thought I had dead eyes. I thought for sure that would be the thing that did it.
My memory of the phone call was that you said, Tom Hanks' senior audition tape,
and he's having second thoughts. He thinks you have dead eyes. Does that jive with your memory of, do you remember any of that?
I have to be honest and say, no, I don't remember that. I have no doubt that's what I said, but I don't remember that, surprisingly. It feels terrible, Connor, but I don't remember it that vividly. Of course, you're on the receiving end of this, and it must have been incredibly acute.
Well, but you would have had to call... I wasn't the only actor you ever delivered bad news to, surely.
Normally, it was a case of I would be dealing with something and then hand it over to Hillary. I can't see why I didn't hand it over to Hillary or why, unless she wasn't there on the Monday morning and I was left holding the baby. It must have been a terrible weekend, but I don't know why I don't recall it so vividly.
Whatever I was doing the weekend before, it was a good weekend for me. I remember thinking the nice weekend was actually an illusion. That I didn't realize I was already, that things had already gone wrong for me, but I just didn't know it yet.
I'm sorry that it's hazy. As I said, I think it was going to be hazy because I might have been distracted by my own predicament. If I had just been Hillary's assistant and sitting on the phone and this had happened, I probably might have remembered it more clearly. But because I might have been distracted by the fact that I also had an agenda with regards to this project, that... it might have influenced it.
When Hillary forwarded me Robert's email address, a lot of her email actually made no sense to me. She wrote, "He does remember things, and it also reminded him that he stood in for his dad at some point and did the Punch and Judy segment, which I believe was cut anyway. So I think you will enjoy chatting with him." Okay, a lot of questions here. Who is his dad? And what does Punch and Judy have to do with any of this? I mean, I know what Punch and Judy are. Those are puppets from olden times who hit each other, yes? It felt like there had been some sort of miscommunication as to what I wanted to talk about. But no, it turns out that this was completely relevant.
I am the secretary of the Punch and Judy Fellowship, and it's something I've been doing since I was 16. My father is the president of the Punch and Judy Fellowship, and I am the interim chair at the moment.
Robert and his dad were both involved in the same episode of Band of Brothers that I was fired from, for a sequence involving a traditional Punch and Judy puppet show being performed on the streets of Paris. And, as Hillary alluded to in the email, the sequence would not make the final cut of the episode. But he still got to film it.
Revisiting the whole story from this angle has brought a lot of it back. I had a very enjoyable day on the set.
After this conversation, Robert and his father extracted a bit of info from their diaries so we can lock in the timeline of what happened when. Robert filmed the puppet sequence for Band of Brothers on Wednesday, July 5th, 2000 at Hatfield. That was a few weeks after I had been fired, so he was having to deal with me while his own thing was about to happen.
There's something so sublime in a way about the fact that I was the one that then had to sort of say to you, oh, you're not doing it. It's not fair.
How did your dad feel about not being able to do that? What was the reason he wasn't able to do the filming on the episode?
He'd actually done the consultations with Tom and the designer. But on the day, he couldn't do the filming, or maybe he knew he couldn't do the filming and it was always going to be me, but he did the consultation.
A few years later, Robert's dad would get the opportunity to work with Tom Hanks again for another Punch and Judy sequence, this time for the 2004 Robert Zemeckis film The Polar Express. This would also not make it to the final cut of the film, but he did get a chance to talk with Hanks about the scene that Robert had shot for episode 5.
He said, oh, I should have shot it from a different angle. There was something that he remembered it and was sorry that he wasn't able to include it. He took responsibility for it.
Your dad was able to have a conversation with Tom Hanks later and hash it out.
Yes, he was able to have that conversation.
It's good to know that conversations like that can occur.
Yes.
On top of that, Robert's brother has also worked with Tom Hanks. He was first assistant director on the 2011 film Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
You have multiple professional connections within your family of working with Tom Hanks. All good experiences, despite the disappointment of the sequences not making in.
Oh, absolutely fine. Yeah, yeah. Found him charming.
That's what I hear. That's what I hear.
When you were on set doing the Punch and Judy stuff, like what's your memory of what it was like on set and specifically with Tom Hanks directing you?
Tom was actually on a stepladder next to me. So he's beside the booth. So he's up high. The camera was on the other side of the booth filming the crowd. He was doing reactions. I can remember I could hear his voice through the canvas. I couldn't see him. And I kept thinking to myself, it's Woody. Woody is on the other side of the booth here. And he said to me, oh, can Mr. Punch do it like the Gettysburg Address? And I said, you try doing that with a swazzle in your mouth, which is this special squeaker. And he said, don't be cheeky. And Mr. Punch was kind of dressed as Hitler with a moustache and swastikas on his arm. And Judy was like a French resistance worker with a beret and a saucepan and vive la France. And it was good fun. And the crowd dispersed and I was left to dismantle what was a hire from us and take everything down. And I was going home. And a car pulled in for him and he walked over to the car and he was talking to people. It was the end of the day. It was the last shot. So I was on my own packing up, really. And he came back from the car and thanked me again. Mm. And I said, thank you. It's a great honor coming from you. And he was very modest about it. And he kind of disappeared and got in the car and drove away.
Oh, that's nice. So that was a great day.
It was a very nice day. Yeah. For you, what you're missing is what was potentially a good memory.
Yeah. I'm building a good experience out of a bad experience.
When Robert was first starting out as an actor, he went through his own series of ups and downs trying to get his career going. He got an agent right out of drama school, and then that agent died.
And when he went, his other clients jumped ship. And the agency that was left, as much as they struggled, for me, it wasn't working.
Everything Robert was telling me about his first few years was familiar to me. It's going well, and then you go through a dry spell, feast or famine. And he even gave it up, not long after I did. He became a flight attendant.
But then 9/11 happened, and suddenly being on a plane was not the kind of career that I wished to continue. And right. So I went back into the business. I went back into being an actor. And it was like being born again at 35. Suddenly I had a new agent. Suddenly I was working a lot and doing a lot more films and TV. My brother was getting me in on bits and pieces. It was good. Mid-30s to mid-40s was a good time. But recently, there obviously things have not been going so well over here. I've had some nice moments, but the parts are getting smaller and I'm being offered one lines on things. I'm not even actually being seen for them. I'm being offered them. The last thing I did was called The Midwife, which is a famous series here. And it was the last shot of the day. I got picked up at 7 o'clock in the morning. I thought there's no need for me to be here this early. And of course, when you see the breakdown, when you get there and you get to your cabin and look at the notes for the day and you realize, oh, we're last up. It's going to be delayed. And when we get there, they're going to be rushing like mad to get it done, which is exactly what it is. It's a mad bollocks scramble. And there's hurry up. And it's appalling. I walked away from it going, oh, I really didn't enjoy that very much at all. So I'm back at Hillary's now as a client. So we've gone full circle. I get seen for various bits and pieces. I'm in my mid-50s now, so I'm more of a character actor than I see myself as doing that kind of stuff.
Robert also teaches acting now, which gives him a chance to pass along some of his knowledge about how the industry works.
I have, with my students, pointed out from examples of things that have happened to me that give them an idea that it isn't all marvellous, darling. But as someone another teacher pointed out to me, they don't want to hear it. They actually don't think it's going to affect them. And to be honest with you, Connor, we probably would have felt exactly the same when we were in our teens and 20s training. Oh no, I'm going to be fine.
It was easy to slot Robert into my narrative as a kind of nameless, faceless, accidental villain. The agent's assistant who thoughtlessly passed on a message so inadvertently hurtful and insulting that it ultimately became the name of this podcast. In my telling of the story, it was often the part that would provoke a visceral reaction from people who would get mad at him on my behalf, like Darcy did. But he wasn't that villain. He was at work, doing his job. And not only do he and I share the bond of being cut from the same episode of a television show, turns out that without Robert, I might not have ever worked as a professional actor at all.
I signed with Hillary when I graduated from Lipa. That was in 98.
Were you in the same year as Kevin Curtin?
Yes, I was, yeah.
Then I came to your showcase, and it was me that made the shortlist up for Hillary.
So you were the one who would have seen me.
Yes.
You're the reason that I would have gotten signed then.
Yeah.
Without you, I wouldn't have had an agent at all. Thank you. I didn't know that.
My pleasure.
I had one thing I wanted from Hillary and Robert. I wanted them to remember what I remembered. I didn't get that from either of them. That one detail, "he thinks you have dead eyes," was not something that stuck with them. All they remembered was that the whole situation was bad. I do have an idea of what went on from their perspective, though. Why it was so different from my experience. And just to be clear, what you're about to hear involves elements of dramatic recreation. If we suddenly discovered recordings of the phone conversations from the year 2000, we would have led with that. Friday, June 9th.
Hillary Gagan Associates.
Hillary's agency receives word from casting that I have to come back and re-audition in advance of Tuesday's scheduled filming. Might have been a message or a phone call. Either way, casting is too loose-lipped and spills the information about me having dead eyes.
I'm afraid we're going to need to have Connor come back in. Tom Hanks has looked at his audition tape and thinks he's got dead eyes.
Right, then.
This is either a phrase of their own concoction or something Tom Hanks said, yet to be determined. They are not able to get a hold of me on Friday. The weekend goes by, and Robert is the person who makes the call first thing Monday morning, June 12th.
Hello, Connor. It's Robert.
Robert relates the urgent message to me as closely as possible.
We were trying to reach you on Friday.
He's exasperated that he wasn't able to reach me earlier because now he's having to tell me to head directly to the train station. The clock is ticking.
You need to get on a train down to London right away. There's been a bit of a problem. It seems Tom Hanks has seen your audition tape and he's having second thoughts. He thinks you have dead eyes.
I am one phone call out of many that Robert has to deal with that morning.
Hillary Gagan Associates.
Multiple clients, auditions being scheduled, casting directors, contracts being sorted out, deals being made.
Hillary Gagan Associates.
If you've ever worked in a high-stress job where you deal with people on the phone all the time, ask yourself this. How many of those phone calls do you remember?
Hillary Gagan Associates.
Beyond that, what about the details of those calls? Would you remember them after a year? 5? 10? 20? When there was no real reason to recall them? I think I naturally would have assumed that Robert sounding stressed on the phone was because of me, but he might not have been stressed at all. Or he might have been stressed about something else entirely. He also had his own Tom Hanks thing looming on the horizon. Robert hangs up the phone and moves on to the next thing. He has more calls to make.
Hillary Gagan.
As for Hillary, I think she may have been more focused on the big picture. Her client losing a job, her trying to go to bat for me, rather than fixating on any of the smaller details.
I cannot tell my client he's just been fired. He hasn't been fired. He got the job.
I know I didn't speak to Hillary about it until it was all over and done with. And I don't remember talking with her about the dead eyes comment at the end of that very long Monday. I was just embarrassed and sad. I felt like I had let her down. And if Suzanne Smith did give Hillary the throwaway excuse about Tom Hanks's nephew, maybe it was just an attempt to save face.
Listen, between you and I, Hanks promised this part to his nephew.
Not even to cover up for the dead eyes comment, but to try and offer an inoffensive explanation to her friend for what had happened. My dead eyes were such a small part of this whole ordeal that they were forgotten by everyone. Except me. The one person who definitely wasn't supposed to have even heard it. So no, I didn't get exactly what I was looking for in talking to these people. What I did get, though, was the knowledge that they hadn't forgotten about me after 2 decades. Not only that, they were still invested emotionally long after I'd stepped out of their lives. That's not what I was looking for, but I'll take it. Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show is produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite. Special thanks to my guests, Hillary Gagan and Robert Stiles, and also to Darcy Carden, Brandon Scott Jones, and Alexandra Dixon. And thanks to Amy Mann for letting us use this song that's playing in the background. It's called I Can't Help You Anymore from her 2005 album, The Forgotten Arm. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts ask you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast, and talk about us nicely on social media. If you want to reach out, the email address is deadeyespodcast@gmail.com. Please tell your friends about this show. Especially if you are friends with Tom Hanks, who played a guy named Robert in a trilogy of films, globetrotting Professor Robert Langdon, in The Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, and Inferno. A man looking into the past, trying to solve mysteries, often involving obscure and forgotten events, occasionally involving the way that major works of art were produced, sometimes finding that there are powerful forces who don't want to cooperate with him. Highly relatable stuff. See you next time. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Hello, Connor. It's Robert. We're trying to reach you on Friday. It seems Tom Hanks has seen your audition tape and, well, he's having second thoughts. He thinks you have... I'm sorry.
That was a HeadGum Original.